welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. We've been looking at a variety of different asset classes and the challenges of investing in this market over recent weeks, but it's been a little while since we've looked at fixed income. And fixed income is really at the epicentre of market forces right now, some of the challenges that we're facing into. So recently, NAB favourite and Sky Business host Mark Todd hosted the Fixed Income Kanga Conference, which brings together fixed income and bond market specialists from across the country to discuss major trends and issues in this space. Mark is here to talk us through some of the headwinds facing investors, some of the insights from the conference, and some of the more interesting things we can be thinking about once the experts have gotten their heads together. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good to see you. Maybe I should background it. Third year.
Okay.
We call it FIBIS, Fixed Income Beyond the Institutional Sector, which is now probably not the right way to describe it because we had so many institutions were there.
Right, okay. So for someone listening who doesn't know what an institution is, I know that sounds funny, but what is an institution for fixed income purposes?
Oh, well, institutions could be somebody like PIMCO.
Like a super fund, like a big
industry
fund
super
manager.
Funds, industry super funds, professional fund managers, people that are managing other people's money.
Yeah. So as a retailer, you know, as a mum and dad investor, the sorts of people who listen to this podcast, institutions, sounds like it's not important, but they're the ones who manage your super for you, for example.
Yeah, that's true. So there was over 650 registrations.
Oh,
I haven't got
wow.
the final number on how many were able to attend because some people register and then they can't work out. Overwhelmingly, the number is around the self-directed wealth person.
Really? So the people who came weren't institutions primarily?
Institutions were a modest number.
Yeah, right. So really people who manage their own money, self-managed super funds.
Massive.
Individuals going, I need to know more. Tell me about
it. This is the third year. The first year we had 200. Year three, we've got over 600.
That's amazing.
It's off the charts. Mm. And what we do is we try and, you know, firstly, we want to entertain, inform, maybe educate. We have no product. There's no product on this thing.
Which is important.
Yeah. And so what we do is we get, basically, you know, I just ring everyone I know and
the ultra professional way of putting together.
Well,
an
it's just if you're an
network,
older head, right? So you say, well, how would I think? What would I want to go to?
Yeah, what do I want to know about? Who knows about that thing?
Yeah. So we had, for example, Kurt Zuber, treasurer of Westpac, Sean Dooley, the treasurer of the NAB, and John Pearce, the chief investment officer for UniSuper, sit on the one panel. And I started it with, in the same way I go to the bank manager and ask for some money and I'm really nice, both these treasurers would go to John Pearce and say, can I have some money?
Yeah.
And how do you make that pitch? What are you saying to John and people like that around how you pitch for money? Because you've got to fund the bank.
Yeah.
We had people like, you know, Dave Hancock from Afterpay talking about his business.
That's an interesting one.
And about how he thinks about his business and how we'd like investors to ponder what's the data you need to look at to understand this business. We had Gary Edwards from AAM, who's an agri fund manager, and the question for us was, if I think of agri right now, I think of the terrible drought that's been impacting people, and how do you think about that? And he talked through, you know, what he thinks is happening in the agri. And then we had Miles George talking about, he's from Brightacre, talking about solar and what's happening in the solar space from an investment perspective, and the dynamic around we want it to be coal and just more, look, this is the trend, this is what's happening, the inevitability of certain things.
Yes.
So that's the way to think about it. It was people talking, there were some fund managers talking about what's in their portfolio and trying to, Anne Mole from Perpetual talking about, okay, this is what I put in the portfolio and this is how I think about it. We had an equity guy in Matt Williams who bringing out Airlie Funds Management. They're bringing out a retail offering similar to their institution. So what do you do? What are you looking at? Mike Baird.
Yeah.
Mike Baird sat with First State Super and Industry Super Fund to just talk about geopolitical risk and how it impacts the investor. And if you think infrastructure, what does that mean in the context of the need for infrastructure globally and then the political risk around that infrastructure spend. So if I change the tax treatment I apply to it or things like that. So that's the sort of, that's the essence of what we tried to achieve. Feedback to date, next day, has been pretty good. Everyone was really happy with it. And I just think it's good for customers to be able to come to these sort of events to say, how are you thinking if you don't have an agenda? And that's the important thing to do. You know, what are people doing with their own investment strategies?
Investors are really fortunate these days. There's a lot of incredible opportunities to access insights online, you know, via email or whether it's going onto websites and so on. Incredible insights from incredibly astute professional people who have access to great information. But to be able to come along for a day and listen to it's really cool. I always like to listen to people in person. It's not always feasible from a practical perspective, but it is really appealing.
Well, so my bugbear is the ramifications of the herd. So the herd goes one way. And I'll give you an example of what really, you know, the most recent herd. I have to be calm about it because, you know, you get so irate. Reuters put out a story that the Bank of Japan would be changing effectively its yield curve, you know, what they would be doing. What that constituted in response was everyone started selling all the government bonds they could find. Like they just started, yields went higher. Okay, so let's think that through. That meant mortgages went higher. That meant the cost of borrowing for corporates would have gone higher over that period. That meant people who are managing money on behalf of other people would have lost money because they held bonds on the basis of what they think was happening. Bank of Japan came out, didn't do what Reuters thought they were going to do. There was some subtle, but there wasn't anything.
Subtle differences.
You know, they said we're going to keep it at zero.
Wow.
And so there was this whole movement around foreign exchange. There was a whole, you know, the herd just went this other way.
Now, so it's a very expensive drama.
Yeah.
Unnecessarily.
And in defense of Reuters, they would have just written a story about what they think is happening. It was just a matter of, they wouldn't have been saying, look at this ramifications, but it was just this herd got together. You know, I just feel that that doesn't help the investors. And I'm not critical, I really want to stress, I'm not critical of Reuters. I'm critical of the herd, and we need to have strategies around why am I trading right now? Is it consistent with the strategy I've got? Now, I'm not saying don't change the strategy, but make a decision to change the strategy and then do something.
And be consistent with that too. Don't respond to every, you know, every fund manager talks about the signal versus the noise. You don't want to be reacting to every signal. Or reacting to every noise, sorry. Do try to react to the signals, that's important. the noise, however, you want to keep that, try to tune it out, right?
Yeah, well, I think so. I think, you know, some of the industry fund managers were fantastic the way they were thinking about it. And they were saying, when you hear somebody say there's nothing to buy, they have got that wrong because there's always something to buy.
Because that's an interesting
insight. The world is incredibly volatile and there are opportunities everywhere. Now, that's because they can see the world at large.
Yeah.
But for the people that are listening to this, there is a lot of assets that you can make a decision on. So you don't have to flick around all the time. But if you get a dividend payment in July, and say there's nothing to buy, I'll just stick it in cash. Well, I could challenge that. You know, you could buy different assets.
So what this fund manager, the industry fund, who was saying, so we're not going to mention any names of particular industry funds and so on, but different groups and their insights. But so what were they buying? If they're saying there's always something to buy, what are they interested in? What are they like?
So they were, if I take it back a step, they were talking about macro themes, like what do you think is happening?
Yes.
So are you looking at Australia in a slowing credit cycle, possibly, so that became less attractive in terms of the banking sector? You stay invested in the banks, but you don't look for great growth.
Yeah.
So if you looked at global banking sector, they said, well, one thing we did was in the recent times that we picked up was the US growth and the benefit to their banking sector, and so we were buying banks. So they're saying, okay, well, maybe you start looking at banking sectors across the curve around the world. That was one thing they were looking at.
Okay.
And they were saying that sort of made sense as the world's economies improve. For viewers here, that they would then say, okay, I would probably think that they could try and find something in the world of the ETF.
Mm.
And so, you know, they were saying the US story is one of real strength.
Yeah. Sector.
So you could get exposure to a sector, or you could get exposure to a country around a sector, and that sort of made sense. And so they thought the US would continue on. I think collectively everyone was of the view that the US would continue on up until a point in time where that the massive sugar hit that took place might run out. So the overarching commentary was around this idea that the economy that was given the tax boost probably didn't need that boost at that point in time.
So this is talking about Trump and his very substantial tax cuts earlier this year.
Yeah. So what happens post that? What happened post that sugar?
Mm.
How do you re-stimulate? And so to an extent...
I've got a 2 and a 4-year-old. I know what a sugar hit looks like.
Yeah.
Getting cupcakes yesterday, dangerous.
Yeah, that's right. So if you think about it from the perspective of what's the next cupcake?
Yeah, and what do you do when the cupcake wears off?
Yeah, so the next cupcake, to an extent, will be the Fed's tightening bias changing. So in other words, let's say it's in 2020, they've got it to a point in time where the Fed funds rate, you've got enough in it that you can stimulate if you see a recession taking place. So that's...
So this is taking rates from... They're not at record lows anymore.
No.
They were at record lows relatively recently. They've increased rates a little bit. They will keep increasing them back to a point where...
So US 10 years went to 3%. So let's say that became the rate, you know, 3% over time. That gives you some movement. You can go back to zero. You can do whatever you like.
Back again if things go pear-shaped, because that's always the massive risk, and certainly a risk we face in Australia, which is, and it was obviously a risk that Japan faced 20 years ago.
And still
faces now. And faces now, which is you cut rates hard and aggressively to stimulate the economy. It doesn't have the desired effect, and then you've got no firepower when things fail to work and you need more.
It's not assistance. Yeah, that's right. So it's not the lower rate that's moving the economy, it's something else. It's much more structural. So it's a function of what is that structure. So with Japan it might be just the aging demographic and it's the challenge. So then they started to think about getting more people into the workforce, changing the corporate behaviour, and that's what's giving the Japanese economy the stimulus that it might need. So I think in the US One way to think about it right now is that it's a very strong economy. They are removing QE. So that will create some...
So it's not just rates going up.
No,
it's actually buying money.
Yeah, so if you think about... The way to ponder this is the old idea of crowding out. So the Fed would have crowded out. That was the goal of QE. I'm going to crowd out with my money so that you as an investor will reallocate your resources somewhere else that will help stimulate the economy. So you might buy other things. I'm now removing that crowding out. So I'm expecting you to flood back in. So what you had been buying, you may not now need to buy. So if you think US Treasuries are 2.5 in the 2 years or whatever they're going to be, 2.6 or whatever it is, when somebody comes to the market who's a corporate and says, look, I want to borrow money at 2.6, they go, well, I can just go to the government at 2.6. You've got to borrow a different number. The other thing to think about is I might have been able to do a $3 billion trade. I now can only do a $1 billion trade. So the way this plays into the broader economy is that people will be borrowing smaller volumes of monies. And... You know, when you say money's sitting on the sideline, it's not as much on the sideline. It's not feeling that sense of it because the reverse of the crowding out. People withdrawing it, I'm filling that hole. You know, you saw the...
So the government was funding everything. Now they're not funding it anymore. It means private enterprise is going to have to do it, or the individual.
Treasury, yeah, that's right. So Treasury yesterday, August the 1st, when day before yesterday, their time, August 2nd, our time, came out with their issuance. I think the rough number is about 60% more than they did the past year.
Wow.
So we're talking billions of dollars, like an extra billion in every different tenor. The numbers are, 300 for 3 months, 400 for for another 3 months. Huge numbers. So the weight of money would need to go there to support that. And then that means what price do other people need to pay?
Mm. Yeah. So the cost of money is going up.
The cost of money is going up. That's right. So the cost of money to the corporate, and well, actually to all of it, to the government and to the corporate world, is probably going up. And so how do you transfer that cost pressure?
Yeah.
Do you sell, so is that inflationary? Can you push those costs through to your customers, or is that impacting profit? Mm. And how significant is it going to be? Overlay all of that with the idea that you might not need the money because you've just got a tax cut. You as a company have a tax cut. So you actually make more money. Yeah. So I don't need to borrow as much. I've actually got some money to go and spend.
Yeah.
So there comes a time where, when does this start to peter out? When does this start to change? Is this a permanent structural change? So it's all fine.
Mm.
I think everyone in the market is trying to understand at what point in time does sugar become, you know, fat? and it holds you back. That's the thing to think about.
So these were the conversations that were happening at the conference. Yeah. So the things that people were talking about, major issues. One positive sign is that global growth is very strong.
Mm.
Australia, we're coming off the back of extensive credit growth, housing boom and so on. So we need to consider how we're going to adjust in that environment.
So on that point on the housing boom, they all universally said, the greater concern in the housing market was that if it rallied another 15%.
Yeah, that's a much bigger risk than it actually tailing off.
And so having rallied for as hard for as long as it has, to see a modest sell-off, no one's worried.
No.
They're all saying that that's good. That takes heat out of the situation. So that's a good thing to do.
That's interesting. I mean, the average homeowner may not feel that way. Certainly a homeowner who's planning to sell may not feel that way.
So there is a lack of sales in that environment. People don't flip houses as much. So it's...
They just sit.
Yeah, it's fine. It's not like you should be using your home as the ATM. You know, will it go up over time? Possibly.
Yeah.
But you're in it because you like it.
Well,
you're not in it because you want to flip it, I think. You know, hopefully you're not in it because you want to flip it. You're in it because you like living in the home you've got.
Mm.
So that's all right. Do that.
Okay, so that's very interesting. So at the institutional level and at the sort of professional level, there wasn't a lot of concern about slowing credit growth in for housing and those things. They're actually really comfortable with that.
Yeah, that's right. They were comfortable with that. They were just saying it'll be good to see how we can create credit that is unaligned to just, I want to buy it for my house, a corporate credit, people borrowing, rebuilding businesses, the productivity story. So that's something you want to focus on. But in broad, generally speaking, people weren't worried about the fact that the house is having a retracement when they've been so strongly rallied.
Yeah. That point you make about reallocation of capital for productive purposes, I think is really important. I saw a piece of data that blew my mind from an economist saying that in Australia, we have this idea of sort of entrepreneurial spirit and people starting businesses and all of these ideas, and certainly the cult around the entrepreneur has been very strong in the last decade, particularly with the tech titans coming through and all this stuff. And this piece of data was saying, in fact, globally, but particularly in Australia, that is actually not what is happening. And about 15 years ago, so in the early 2000s, there was a dramatic switch between people choosing to invest in their own businesses and choosing to invest in property. And they stopped believing that if you want to get rich, you need to become a business owner. So decades ago, if you wanted to get rich, in inverted commas, so you didn't want to just be well off, you wanted to be rich, you needed to build your own business and be a successful business person.
Sir.
That's the way to become rich.
Yeah.
The mentality changed after the 2000 housing boom, or the early 2000s housing boom, to be if you want to get rich, you need to invest in property. And so people started investing all of their surplus capital into property and not into businesses, which I thought was a shocking statistic, because productive capital, houses are essential, they're an essential item, but they're not a productive item. Mm. They don't produce anything for the economy or for people. If you're building new ones, sure, people are employed, but if you're just living in them and renting them, then they're a passive asset. And this idea that people are taking their capital and deploying it for passive purposes to become wealthy rather than for productive purposes.
How much of that it would be around an aging demographic? How much of that is around the idea that having spent, because I've got this theme in my head, that As Australia ages in its own business cycle, as people, I'm running my business. Mm. How do I transition? Mm. I could sell my business. Do I sell it on Monday, or do I plan to sell it in 3 years' time? And so the money I've got, do I then put it into property? Because I think that's a pretty conservative thing, and it's gone up. Mm. So do I think about it that way, around what's the reallocation of the assets in my transition? And then I'm trying to find out how to sell it. Do I take an ad out in the paper, or what, do I go through a business broker? There is something in my mind that says it's an untapped story around how people are transitioning from different generations. Do I give you all the business and therefore I hope that you pay me to retire, or do I sell part of it, you take part of it? You know, what are you doing? And we're having those conversations, and that's what AAM was talking about, that business transition in rural around how do you, what do you do here?
And succession planning is just so difficult.
And but it's not, and we think about it purely as the farming land, but it wasn't just that. It was a whole range of different things that they are saying businesses that they need to change. So if they transition, how are they going to transition? I'm not 100% certain that they've got that plan. And part of the things that I learned from the day with the various, or an array of super funds, was around communication and how are people thinking about their assets. And I think they get to a point in time where they say, hang on, I need to transition my business. And I was saying, well, how is it that you feel you're engaging with the members? And they, everyone, and they were all talking about this and saying, no one's got the solution. No one's worked this out, because you engage with clients to the best of your ability, and the wealth effect is lost on them because people are really busy. They were very understanding of the fact that people are really busy in their own life and don't have time to look at their super fund on a daily basis or a monthly basis or whatever basis to say, you know what, I feel really good about it. I'm getting more affluent. I'm feeling better about it. I have a wealth effect. You know, I guess it goes into default pensions predominantly. It was how do they were really keen to try and think of different ways to engage with members and customers.
So this is a really, and it comes back to the conversation we're literally just having about property. I think one of the reasons, so there are two reasons I think people started investing in property rather than in personal businesses. One is there'd been such a dramatic increase in property values. So we feel it over the last 5 years, certainly in the major capital cities. But it also happened in the early 2000s, so post the introduction of the GST and particularly first homeowners grants and these sorts of things. It was huge growth in housing prices in Australia, and driven by many demographics. One was, you know, women going back to work and staying at work, therefore you've got two incomes to pay it off, that kind of stuff. When you only had one income, you couldn't afford to pay double. One thing was simply that house prices doubled in 5 years, and that makes people feel like it must be the best asset in the world to invest in. How exciting. Yeah. And then the other, though, is that people are looking forward to retirement. We have a population of baby boomers who are retiring very soon or are retired already. And 10 years ago, they were going, or 15 years ago, oh gosh, I'm coming up to retirement. I need to have some assets behind me. The superannuation guarantee had only been at 9% for a couple of years at that point in time. They didn't have meaningful superannuation balances. They're looking for a tangible asset to invest in prior to retirement. Tech crash had happened, so shares were probably on the nose a little bit. Yeah. And I think a lot of people understood the tax breaks around property. So negative gearing, capital gains tax, concessions and so on, and went, property looks like a brilliant asset to save for my retirement. Now, it's not an asset for saving, right? It's not a savings vehicle, but I think a lot of people like seeing something tangible. And your point about superannuation is it's a structure, not an investment. You know, it's not an asset class. You can hold property inside superannuation if you wish, and all of the major super funds hold many properties in them, but as a small allocation of a diversified portfolio. People chose to ignore super to a point because it feels intangible and they weren't in control of it, and invest in property as an alternative. Now, the other thing we've seen is the rise of self-managed super funds, which is very literally taking your super and making it tangible, because you have to make active decisions about how it's invested.
Yeah, and I think one of the, you know, I think there is a generational issue because the people who might be retiring now may not have been in the system, the super benefit compound system.
They weren't.
So they're coming out with $250,000 whereas their children will come out with 750 to a million because they've been in it for so much longer.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that maybe ultimately they'll have that wealth effect and think about it in that way. And that all makes sense. So it's just, I think, a policy challenge for government to work out how do people retire.
Yes.
You want to fund yourself, you know, yes, I want you to fund yourself, but you want to, what's the lifestyle look like on that money that you're about to get? So the government contributes. And the government will want to contribute less where possible, but at the same time, you don't want people living in really bad conditions.
No,
to do some management of it all.
So you have a series of experts there on the day discussing all of these different issues. So they're talking about, as you say, how do we engage members? How do we ensure they get the best investment outcomes by finding opportunities, even in a market where things look quite challenging or very expensive, rather than challenging, they just look expensive. A lot of assets just look expensive, hard to buy. There are some interesting headwinds when you look to an economy like the US, which is still the powerhouse. Massive sugar hit with QE 10 years ago and tax cuts now, and how does all of that play out? We had a conversation before this, so I'm setting you up here, but any really interesting things come out of it?
Well, the thing that everyone was talking about, there was a panel there where we talked to a bunch of fund managers and said, you know, make the case, you know, help me understand why we should give you some money.
Yeah, why would I invest with you?
So we had organisations who might be natural borrowers, either at the equity or debt level.
Mm-hmm.
But then we had fund managers and we were saying, okay, so make the case for why you are a good fund manager. Like, explain to me why you should get money.
If I've got $10,000, why do I give it to you rather than buying an ETF?
Yeah, and then we talked about this idea that Fidelity had brought out. The first question I explained to them was on the morning, I read an article on Bloomberg that Fidelity had brought out two mutual funds in which they would charge zero fees. And there was speculation.
Sorry, just say that again.
So Fidelity had announced.
It's a huge US-based fund manager.
Yeah, had announced that they would bring out two of these funds who would invest in, and I didn't even look at it because I was just moving forward to see the number, that they would not charge any fees at all for the people that bought that. So I guess.
So this
the
is
speculation
amazing.
Was
to put it in context, what's the average fund manager fee in Australia, do you think?
But just put it in the context of ETFs, it's 30 basis points, 20 basis points, you know, 2 basis. It's been going lower and lower.
Yeah, and there's been a real. But for an active fund manager, and I don't know if this is active.
So I don't know if it was active. I was just looking at it and thinking, okay, this is really.
Zero. How do you get paid?
Yeah, so it's all.
How do you make money out
so
of
the
it?
Speculation was that they would make money with the underlying assets. Because they could lend it out, they could repo it out and do different things.
Mm.
And that they would get the customer in and they would be doing different, you know, bits and pieces with the customer and all that loss leading idea.
Yes.
So, okay, it's a loss leading idea. So the question I had for everyone was if that's a zero.
If that's a model in the US now, or it's certainly
how do you,
an innovative
you know,
product.
And what do you do? And they talked about the individuality of their strategies. And about, I think one of the ways to think about this is post GFC, people would be more comfortable talking about money, the, you know, what fees you earn. Post GFC, the managers have not yet, these guys, these people, were moving through a stage where they're able to explain their value add much more succinctly.
Mm.
And I think that is a really crucial evolution because we are still in a relatively low yield environment and I can't afford to spend all my money on a manager. I can't afford to spend in terms of the return. It's not enough. So I need to be more targeted with my fee paying dollar.
Yes.
So I need to be able to say what part is pure franchise, like what part is the fact you're just going to invest on large caps and who cares, you're not going to move around.
Mm.
To the alpha, the outcome. So what part is the outcome? You need to explain that alpha, and I need to agree that's the right strategy for me, therefore I'll pay, I'll give you some money. So for example, if you wanted to buy into the US market, you could go through you know various fund managers who might be experts. So you need to work out, have I got the right expert to buy into the US market and will I pay a fee for that?
Yes.
So we're talking to Neuberger Berman about the market. It's that might not be for everyone, and they don't have anything out. But it was just this idea that you have to find the fund manager for you, and that's what we were talking about. Like, what do you do? And so Neuberger Berman were talking to us about this is what we do. And I think that evolution of understanding your value add as opposed to the sector.
Yeah.
Do you get what I mean? Like, I want to buy high yield US credit because I think the US economy is going well. Mm. And so those companies will make money and pay off their debt. That's my sector approach. Okay. Who is the one that does that the most efficiently? And it's that way to think about it. And that's what they were talking about. How previously it's just been everyone drop your rate.
Yeah.
Now it was, well, I won't drop my rate because of this. This is what I'm doing. And this is why, you know, one guy was talking about, I've got four PhDs and this is what we're doing around trying to understand credit. And so
four PhDs.
So he had four PhD people that work for him to get
Four people who work for him with PhDs. I thought he personally had four. That's a lot.
No, no, four PhDs, four people who have PhDs working for him on specific sector stuff. And so he's saying, I need to make people understand that. Because if you're reluctant to pay for
specialist
research.
Specialist allocation of your funds rather than generalist now.
I think that makes sense.
This is quite interesting. So when I was working with financial planners many years ago, like 15 years ago, there was this idea of a core plus satellite approach. And the core of your money would go into really basic stuff like the ASX 200, S&P 500, and it would just give you access to the market in inverted commas. And so you would put maybe 60% into that, whatever your allocation is for your personal needs and so on. You put 60% into that, the other 40% you would allocate sector bets, exactly as you're saying, to things that you're interested in and where you think there are opportunities. And exactly as you're saying now, and what has changed though is the core used to be still an actively managed portfolio. Now it's less likely to be actively managed. It's more likely to be an ETF or an index fund or something passively managed. Yeah. And people are then looking for specialist managers in these other areas. But you're really happy to pay a fee where someone can go and get you alpha in an area. Or the other thing I'm finding increasingly interesting is where they can access a market you just can't access yourself.
Well, that's the whole point of it. You know, I can't access the loan market in the US. So there's no way, how can I do that?
Yeah.
So it's this idea that you say, you know, one of the managers who is an incredibly good investor is saying it's about the discipline. The first discipline is the macro view.
Yeah.
If you don't start with the macro view and say, okay, that economy is going really well, and therefore the beneficiary of that economy will be X.
Yeah.
Who do I find within the X, whether it be direct or through a manager, having that macro view. So when everyone says to me, interest rates are going up, get rid of all your REITs. Okay, well, that's just so, that's old way of thinking.
Yeah.
You know, if interest rates go up, I need to take a macro view on the REIT market. So I need to look at what's the duration? What's their interest rate coverage? Like, what have they hedged? You know, if rates are going up, for what reason? It's because it's inflation or whatever it might be. Okay, how much of the REIT market is aligned to CPI plus rent reviews?
Yeah.
So while I'm thinking of this gradual rate rise, these people are generating 6% cash. And okay, in terms of property, I'm getting 6% cash for that. That's okay. I'm okay with that. I might be. I'm not sure you are. It doesn't really matter. But
you sort of put some thinking into it rather than writing off an entire sector based on one thing.
Completely out because I think rates are going up. Okay, that's not bright.
It's there's so many interesting elements that flow out of that, but I think it's an incredibly important point to make. And we do see this from our investors. We do see them doing this, and certainly it's how I manage my portfolio, which is this very a core that I'm comfortable to just be long only, really simple stuff, and then to look for the interesting opportunities outside that. The challenge then becomes finding the interesting opportunities, but you've got specialists telling you there's always something. There's always something.
Like we will, on NabTrade, have an array of different ideas that will come to market, probably, you know, if not every month, close to it, whether it be the various issuers that come to market, whether it be what's happening in hybrids, whether it be purely whatever, what's the cash account paying? You know, like I'm getting a high interest account that's paying a really good rate. You know, there is so much out there that you could say, why don't I enjoy it rather than be burdened by it? And so, look, okay, I've got some money today. What am I going to look at?
Yeah.
And how's that consistent with my strategy of getting 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever you want to get to whatever duration you need to be invested for, that's interesting. Make it enjoyable. The, you know, NAB Trade Portal, it's got a lot of things that you can go and look at.
Mm.
Just, you know, I think there's 20,000 unique users every day. Spend, I don't know, 30 minutes Saturday morning.
Yeah,
bit of reading, what keeps me interested, and just compare it to what is relevant. I think, you know, I think we put up a video there on NextDC, the CEO of Craig Scroggie. Nothing to sell, just talking about his business.
Yeah.
And a lot of our customers will own equity in NextDC, so, well, opportunity just to touch base. You know, Deutsche Bank came out with a sell recommendation. We did the video prior to that.
Mm.
To some extent, Craig was talking about those issues that Deutsche Bank were talking about, and so it was interesting to hear him thinking about customers and what he's doing. And, you know, it's the same with yesterday we spoke with Afterpay, just talking about their business. Mm. I think there is something to be said for the content that we're putting on NAB Trade with you guys that says, I can actually hear that customer.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that's helpful. There is literally nothing to say, come and buy my equity. We want to hear them talk about their business to see where the passion lies. Are they thinking about the business in the same way we'd like them to think about it?
Being transparent about it also. So Mark, I am guessing that a lot of investors, and certainly last time you spoke about a roadshow you were doing, we got a lot of follow-up from people saying, please can I be on the mailing list for this sort of thing, and we want to know about it in advance and we want to be able to come along. How do people ensure that they hear about these sorts of things from you?
We do. Absolutely, that's a good point. We did do a mail out, so a lot of customers came from the NAB Trade Portal to that mail out.
So if someone sends an email to the Your Wealth email address, we can add them to your mailing list? Is
absolutely
that the obvious thing to do?
No problem. We can do that. We'll anyone that wants to hear, we're very happy to engage. So our goal is literally just to inform first. You know, the conference is to entertain. You can see people talk, and that's really interesting.
But they're really high-quality speakers who have a meaningful impact on very large amounts of money, which retail investors are affected by, right? Your head of treasury at NAB and head of treasury at Westpac and chief investment officer of UniSuper, those people have a very large day-to-day impact on individuals.
Yeah, everyone. They impact everyone.
Yeah.
They fund
so
those big organisations, and they work out what's happening in that funding and what they have to say, and, you know, what are global investors asking of them? Is it still the property market, or is it the alignment to China? It's that sort of stuff. So I thought that was really great. And so if anyone wants to hear from us, no problem. You know, we're happy to just continue to provide information. You know, we don't want to provide advice because we don't know where things are going. We just want to say, external to the white noise, this is how people are thinking. So people like you are doing the following. And I think that really helps people to say, oh, yep, that makes sense to me, rather than I read a Reuters report and I'm going to sell JGBs. Not so much.
Mark, thanks so much for joining me.
Pleasure. It's been good fun.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Your Wealth Podcast. We hope, as always, it is helpful to you as you build and invest your wealth. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, or you would like to be on Mark's mailing list because he does have some really interesting events and content throughout the year, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.